Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm honored to have as my guest C.K. Williams, whose collected poems was published recently by Farrah Straus and Giroux. It's the entire work, years and years of work of a poet whose work has gone from the intensities of shocking symbols that one imagined connections between to the more recent work, which is a wording of what might be called inner silences, finding how thought can be wordable. And the principle seems to be that of continuity, continuous connectedness, the mind displaying itself at work within the poem itself, and that thought is something like a natural growth. The poems sometimes sound the way William Carlos Williams describes a flower growing and opening, the syntax taking on the nature of thought and movement itself. I thought that we would begin with a poem that quite explores inner space and time, a poem among the new poems called The Gaff. This is C.K. Williams.
The Gaff. If that someone who's me, yet not me, yet who judges me, is always with me, as he is, shouldn't he have been there when I said so long ago that thing I said? If he who rakes me with such not trivial shame for minor sins now were there then, shouldn't he have warned me he'd even now devastate me for my unpardonable affront? I'm a child then, yet already I've composed this conscience beast who harries me. Is there anything else I can say with certainty about who I was, except that I, that he, could already draw from infinitesimal transgressions complex chords of remorse and orchestrate ever undiminishing retribution from the hapless rest of myself? The son of some friends of my parents has died, and my parents, paying their call, take me along, and I'm sent out with the dead boy's brother and some others to play. We're joking around, and words come to my mind, which to my amazement are said. How do you know when you can laugh when somebody dies? Your brother dies, is what's said. And the others go quiet. The backyard goes quiet. Everyone stares. And I want to know now why that someone in me who's me yet not me, let me say it. Shouldn't he have told me the contrition cycle would from then be ever upon me? It didn't matter that I'd really only wanted to know how grief ends and when. I could hear the boy's mother sobbing inside, then stopping, sobbing, then stopping. Was the end of her grief already there? Had her someone in her told her it would end? Was her someone in her kinder to her, not tearing at her, as mine did, still does, me, for guessing grief someday ends? Is that why her sobbing stopped sometimes? She didn't laugh, though, or I never heard her. How do you know when you can laugh? Why couldn't someone have been there in me, not just to accuse me, but to explain? The kids were playing again. I was playing. I didn't hear anything more from inside. The way now sometimes what's in me is silent too, and sometimes though never really, forgets.
Now, this is a subject for you, the development of conscience, and the suggestion here that there are other people whose consciences are gentler to them than one's own is to one seems to be a kind of fascinating subject in what I think of as the investigation of invisibilities. Can you talk about this?
I guess the development of consciousness, of conscience, and of consciousness are things which intrigue me very much. And the question of which starts first is always an intriguing question. The idea of other people's consciousness is a vast one because, in a sense, it's what politics is. It's what social life is. It's our imagination of what other people's conscience consists of and theirs of ours. And it's sort of remarkable how many different versions of conscience and any question that demands conscience we can get into. In this poem, I think that when I speak of the mother's conscience and the person inside the mother, I'm using a bit of irony because, of course, what I'm saying really is that what was happening to her was completely unknowable to me as a child and in some senses unknowable still. Grief is, that's really what the poem is about to a great extent, is the knowability of grief. And I'm always fascinated by the fact that I don't really even understand my own grief for things, and that the way grief sometimes comes and leaps out of you in ways you wouldn't expect, that your voice breaks or you can actually begin crying. And so this notion of the development of our inner life is much more disorderly than we're taught it is. And it is a question that I often think about in my poems, I think.
Well, what it brought to mind is how frequently it is writers who are held responsible years and years later for what they said years before, and that poets who wrote during the Vietnam years poems that may no longer carry the kinds of emotional vibration that they now believe in are still, you know, pointed to, look at what you said, you know. Mm. Times change. So I began to think of the way in which writers become responsible for their gaffes as well, not just children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. I guess I've had a strange experience with my Vietnam poems because at the time they weren't terribly well received. Part of what I was trying to do in them, to continue what we were speaking about, was to try to find in myself the places in humanity where war could start and war could continue despite the evidence of a constant theme with me was the death of children. My daughter had just been born. And ironically, now people read them as though they're germane to what's going on now with the Iraq War. But they're expressed in a way I would never express the feelings now. So I don't think of them as gaffes. I think of them as sort of a previous self, in a way that I don't with almost any other of my poems, because the way I speak about those things is now so completely different.
In this poem, the children are playing outside, which allows, in the last set of lines, an incredible moment where you say, I didn't hear anything more from inside.
Yeah.
Inside is where the adults are, but inside is also where the conscience is.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of phrasing that lets the poem address two simultaneous conditions seems very moving and characteristic to me.
It's also a very felicitous accident when things like that happen. I didn't plan it. You know, I was just thinking in the early drafts of it, of the woman inside and me outside. And then when that line happened and that phrase came, I thought, boy, isn't that nice.
But isn't that what your poems are about, in a sense, thinking successively enough to find moments like that?
That would be part of, certainly, of my poetic project, of finding how the truth manifests in those moments.
Because I seem to notice, as I read poems that are written around the same time or appear in the same book, that the poems start to address one another, that the exploration seems thoroughgoing, mm-hmm. that now, if before one had to connect images within a single poem with acts of imagination, now I find myself, when I'm reading you, connecting one poem and the next, making a continuity in thought.
But I don't in any sense try to connect the poems one to the other, the way some poets do.
It's interesting because, you know, I'm thinking about the poem, The Singing, in which there is another kind of silent duet, this not with an internal world, the conscience, but an external world, a figure who compels acts of mental consciousness, mental awareness of the other. Mm-hmm. And I find myself pairing these two poems in a peculiar way.
Mm-hmm. No, I can see that.
Let's hear it, though.
Okay. The Singing. I was walking home down a hill near our house on a balmy afternoon under the blossoms of the pear trees that go flamboyantly mad here every spring with their burgeoning forth, when a young man turned in from a corner singing. No, it was more of a cadence shouting, most of which I couldn't catch, I thought, because the young man was black, speaking black. It didn't matter. I could tell he was making his song up, which pleased me. He was nice-looking, husky, dressed in some style of big pants, obviously full of himself, hence his lyrical flowing over. We went along in the same direction, then he noticed me there almost beside him. And big, he shouted, sang, big. And I thought how droll to have my height incorporated in his song. So I smiled, but the face of the young man showed nothing. He looked, in fact, pointedly away, and his song changed. I'm not a nice person, he chanted. I'm not a nice person. No menace was meant, I gathered, no particular threat, but he did want to be certain I knew that if my smile implied I conceived of anything like concord between us, I should forget it. That's all. Nothing else happened. His song became indecipherable to me again. He arrived where he was going, a house where a girl in braids waited for him on the porch. That was all. No one saw, no one heard. All the unasked and unanswered questions were left where they were. It occurred to me to sing back, I'm not a nice person either. But I couldn't come up with a tune. Besides, I wouldn't have meant it, nor he have believed it. Both of us knew just where we were in the duet we composed, the equation we made, the conventions to which we were condemned. Sometimes it feels, even when no one is there, that someone, something, is watching and listening. Someone to rectify, redo, remake. This time again, though, no one saw nor heard. No one was there.
C.K. Williams reading his poem, The Singing. It's the title poem of the collection just before this, Collected Poems, which has been published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking to C.K. Williams about his collected poems. What is that thing that is listening to this silent duet? What kind of thing is it?
Well, that's what the poem is about. There doesn't seem to be anything listening. I'm quite fascinated with our narrative sense of ourselves, that we tell our story to ourselves often. In fact, we tell it all the time. We tell fragments of it. Certain times we stop and we try to tell the whole story of our existence and our lives to ourselves. And when we do that, we have a sense that someone is listening. We're telling this narrative not just to ourselves, but there's something about our mind that creates a listener, even though we know no one is there. And it fascinates me how much of what we do in our life implies a listener who will be listening to the story of what we've done. And this story, which is, of course, about racial relations in America, which have been so convoluted and sometimes catastrophic, that narrative doesn't have anyone listening. It doesn't have anyone tempering things. And that when that you realize that, it sometimes happens in conditions of potential violence where you realize, wait a minute, it happened to me in New York a few weeks ago. I brushed by a young black man in the street who looked very much like the kid in this poem. And he turned to me, and it was clear there was violence, that what I had done to him implied a kind of racial violence, which, of course, it didn't. I was just in a hurry. And this was the opposite. But there is still that notion that someone is going to be there to solve these things, that's going to resolve these things, and it's going to put them in their metaphysical place, their cosmic place. And then there are these moments. In this poem, it's almost light, but they're moments of great disappointment when you suddenly realize, wait, it's just me and what's inside me and him and what's inside him, and they're never going to come together.
I had a strange experience a little bit like that. I went to see the Watts Towers reopen, and there were a lot of street poetry and street music groups around. And out of the blue, this group of street poets started improvising a poem that began, "Silverbat, come out of the mist." And, you know, when I first moved to California, they left the L out of my name on my checkbook. So for a while, I was calling myself Silverbat. And, you know, the strangeness of hearing oneself invoked is enormous. And, you know, you want to start a conversation, but the conversation doesn't have a way of beginning. You just appreciate the fact that sometimes life makes an inadvertent gesture to remind you that you're not talking, mm-hmm. you know, that you're not in conversation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these narratives, or their absence, seem to add up to a condition of not enough self. And in the poem I'm going to ask you to read, there's an absolutely astonishing sense of that narrative you're talking about that we tell ourselves failing in some way. It's a poem called This Happened. This is C.K. Williams reading from his collected poems.
This happened. A student, a young woman, in a fourth-floor hallway of her lycée, perched on the ledge of an open window, chatting with friends between classes. A teacher passes and chides her. "Be careful, you might fall." Almost banteringly chides her. "You might fall." And the young woman, 18, a girl really, though she wouldn't think that, as brilliant as she is, first in her class and beautiful too, she's often told, smiles back and leans into the open window, which wouldn't even be open if it were winter. If it were winter, someone would have closed it. Close it. leans into the window farther, still smiling, farther and farther, though it takes less time than this, really an instant, and lets herself fall. Herself fall. A casual impulse, a fancy, never thought of until now, hardly thought of even now. No, more than impulse or fancy, the girl knows what she's doing. The girl means something. The girl means to mean, because it occurs to her in that instant that beautiful or not, bright, yes or no, she's not who she is. She's not the person she is. And the reason, she suddenly knows, is that there's been so much premeditation where she is, so much plotting and planning. There's hardly a person where she is, or if there is, it's not her or not wholly her. It's a self inhabited, lived in by her. And seemingly, even as she thinks it, she knows what's been missing. Grace. Not premeditation, but grace, a kind of being in the world spontaneously, with grace. Waitfully upon me was the world, waitfully this self which graced the world, yet never wholly itself. Waitfully this self which weighed upon me, the release from which is what I desire and what I achieve. And the girl remembers in this infinite instant already so many times divided the grief she felt once, hardly knowing she felt it, to merely inhabit herself. Yes, the girl falls, absurd to fall. Even the earth, with its compulsion to take unto itself all that falls, must know that falling is absurd. Yet the girl falling isn't myself, or she is myself, but a self I took of my own volition unto myself. Forever, with grace, this happened.
C.K. Williams reading This Happened. Now, I would like to know about the origins of that poem.
The origins, we're just hearing from the daughter of a friend of mine about a girl and her lycée in Paris who had done just this, that she'd been sitting on the side, edge of the window and had basically taken that occasion to commit suicide. And then there was another girl in the same, just outside that circle of friends who did it, and then one more who was a friend of the parents in Chicago whose daughter did it. And the suicide of young people is, of course, an incredibly audaciously tragic subject. And I really didn't know what to do with it. I knew I wanted to do something. And the beginnings of parts of the poem were just sort of built up out of what I had heard happen and then trying to identify myself with a child who would do this. And trying to imagine what was it that could possibly have taken such a, quote, superior person and made them do it. And that worked out. And then the last part about waitfully upon me was the world. I don't know how that happened. I can't describe even now if someone asked me, describe what's happening there. I can't describe it. It was just, I was taken by the theme and by the girls themselves, and I just sort of became one of them for a moment. And then I sort of come out of it again and leave the girl her moment of this act, which was somehow so important to her, so crucial to her.
But I am curious, does the poet here become the conscience of the culture or of the culture that reads him? Is that, you know, an obligatory role, a role worked into the nature of being a poet? Certainly it's something that Yeats feels and then abandons and then feels again and abandons and gets angry at and takes up again.
Yeah.
The voice of the conscience of the culture.
It's one of the strange things about poetry. Someone's recently asked me to write a definition of poetry for high school teachers for a magazine. I'm trying to think of how to do it. But poetry has so many different definitions. Someone like Yeats has so many different definitions just in his poetry. The most glorious, in a way, is the pure lyric, the pure song that poetry makes of language, that almost doesn't matter what it means, as long as it doesn't mean something horrible, I suppose. And the conscience of the poetry is, for me, something that can either precede or come out of the lyric. The lyric has to be there. The question is, does the lyric connect us with our culture? That's something that a poet can't know because about his own poetry. You can know it about other people's poetry. I know that Yeats can connect me with even the culture I'm in now, even though it was such a different culture. I know that there are many contemporary poets who can. Oneself, one doesn't know because you're concentrating so much on that lyric. You know, if the conscience starts first, it's almost incidental because it has to be resolved into the lyric. If the lyric starts first, it's almost incidental because it has to find its meaning, and the meaning is conscience. It can be a very light meaning, but there'll be something in conscience, consciousness, which is almost can be one word, I think. So I don't know what I can say about my poetry, and in a way I don't know ultimately what I can say about poetry's relation to culture because I'm so in it. Culture has to say that. If culture ever says yes, poetry is part of our conscience. Fine.
I've been speaking with C.K. Williams on the occasion of the publication of his collected poems by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You can read some of C.K. Williams' collected poems on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.